lovely listeners, welcome to Human Magic Podcasts. If you haven't heard this podcast before, then it's basically me. My name is Jack Hutchcraft. I'm a journalist and I'm a musician, and I'm trying to learn about the world that we live in and the people that inhabit it, because, you know, there's a lot going on out there. So this is a conversation I had with Millie Charles, who is a fellow journalist. She's worked with the BBC, among other places. She's a DJ, she's played Wilderness Festival, she's has her own show on Threads Radio, and she's also, pardon me, she's also a new mum. So she's had a little baby called Wolfgang. She's had quite a journey to get to where she is now. This is one of the reasons we wanted to talk on the podcast. We talk about her struggles with drug addiction, with poor mental health. But we also talk about, like, inspiration at her work. You know, she's got a wonderful body of work. Following your dreams, you know, perhaps a little bit later in life, if that's how your life pans out, and just empowerment in general. So she's a good friend of mine, and I really did enjoy talking to her, and I found it very enlightening. Thank you for listening to this, and let's catch up at the end.
Okay, 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, perfect.
Ish. Ish.
All right, nice one, Millie. Thank you for talking to me today. It's been a while.
We spoke
a couple of weeks ago. I'll introduce how we know each other, because you're one of the people that I've had on the podcast that I actually know personally. So we met because our mutual friend Joe and
who was round for tea today, by the way.
Was she really?
Yeah.
Hey, legend. Oh, she lives in Bristol, obviously.
Yeah. We followed each other around. Anyway, carry on. Back to the story, sorry.
That's all right. So we did a Christmas song together. We released it. It was called Snowflakes and Broken Hearts. And
I remember it well.
And we had... And you came down because you're her friend, and you took some photos of us to down the canal near where I live in South Tottenham. And they and the photos were great. I thought it really captured the Christmassy feel. We had a red wine beside the houseboats. There's something quite festive about that, I thought.
And then
we just got on because obviously, well, we're both journalists, and we had a friendship from there. So,
yeah, and I was also living in the same area, so I was local, wasn't I?
Exactly. We were neighbours, but we're no longer neighbours. So,
no, I've moved away. But yeah, no, those were good times. I think you should re-release the single this year, definitely. I don't think it got the attention it should have. It should have become a classic.
I know. Yeah. I mean, in my circles, it is. By my circles, I mean. Just me and maybe my brother, but I might do a re-release. It was 4 years ago. Christmas is just around the corner. Why not? And you've had a baby since last time I saw you. You've had a baby.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, I have. He's nearly 8 months. Well, he's 8 months next week.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, he's amazing. He's a real bundle of joy and a real character. And yeah, he's absolutely gorgeous. He's really, really amazing.
Amazing. So that's not the only change you've had in your life recently. You've moved back to Bristol, right? Because you lived in London when I met you, but you're from near Bristol. And how has it been moving back there? And we'll get on to whatever we get on to after that. But you've moved back to Bristol.
Yeah, I have. Yes, I have moved back to Bristol. Bristol, it's good. I mean, I've moved back, obviously, at this weird time in the middle of the pandemic. So it's not been quite as sociable as I might have liked. But it's nice because I'm near my family, and I have nieces and brothers and sisters and mum around here. So that's great. It's a lovely city. And it's nice. It's nice to be here. It was a bit overwhelming for me because I've had some of my sort of lowest points in life in Bristol, as well as some really good times in Bristol, amazing times, some of my best times in my life in Bristol as well. But yeah, it's kind of, it kind of, because I moved away from Bristol, I kind of had forgotten lots of bits of my life that had, you know, yeah, I'd kind of buried, I guess, a little bit, or just forgotten about because I'd not been in those places. You walk down a street and suddenly a memory is triggered. I found it kind of quite overwhelming at first, but I've definitely settled now and I'm loving it again.
Oh, right. And, okay. Yeah. That's a good thing. Yeah, it's because part of your journey that I wanted to talk about today is your recovery from addiction. And I guess the same streets that you're now walking down, your life is very different now to how it was at that time of your life.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I'm living quite a very, very wholesome life now, which is a million miles away from, you know, other times. I've lived here at various points in my life, but the very last time I was here was at the tail end of a relapse. And, you know, I was kind of scuttling around and in the darkness, you know, both figuratively and literally and metaphorically. In all ways, basically. I was just kind of, pretty like on my last legs, really. Scoring on the corner of the street that I live on now. And now I have a beautiful bonny baby that I'm pushing around in a little buggy, and we're going to get organic vegetables to feed him from the corner shop. So it does feel like a million miles away. And I think, you know, if that past me could see this future me, oh my God, it would have just been, you know, amazing. Because all I ever really wanted was that sort of normality. Deep down, I wanted that normality of having a loving family and having a child and somewhere safe and warm to live and, you know, inner peace and all of that sort of stuff, which seems so, so elusive to me when I was at my kind of lowest ebb. I wouldn't have believed you if you told me it was possible for me, basically.
Wow.
So
can you tell me about, if you don't mind, like growing up in the West Country, like, because I understand that you're, through conversations we've had in the past, that your problems with addiction started in your teenage years. Is that right?
I grew up in a small town, and I was quite a kind of capable student. I mean, there's nothing kind of that significant, I suppose, ostensibly about my childhood. My parents split up when I was quite young. I definitely had difficult relationships with both. But from a very young age, I started kind of displaying signs of not being all right, basically. And it first showed itself in, a depression, and then quite quickly that turned into sort of an eating disorder. And by the age of like 12, I was sort of, I think I, it's all very blurry actually now, it feels like it's quite a long time ago, but yeah, I was definitely in psychiatric care from a young age, and then put in hospital actually when I was 14, for most of my sort of final year at school. And and then it just kind of went on from there. I mean, this was the kind of the pattern. It was, I'd kind of reach a crisis point, I'd go into a facility, whether that was an eating disorders unit or a rehab or a hospital, make some improvement, go out, life would like get a bit of hope, maybe kind of live life like in a better way for a little while, and then I'd fall back down in one way or another. And it was quite frustrating, I guess, and lots of people's hopes were sort of rising and falling, and as I was kind of making a recovery and then getting worse, and that's kind of how, in a nutshell, that's kind of like the story of the first kind of few decades of my life, really. My teens and 20s were very much about that, and, you know, the circumstances changed as I progressed. I mean, I came out of that first hospital, and I was living in a hostel at the age of like 15 or 16, I think. And that's when I sort of started to get involved in, partying and working in pubs and clubs and kind of met my first boyfriend who's a DJ and promoter, and, you know, very much fell in love with that world. And, you know, it was really, really good for a short time. But unfortunately, someone like me, you know, like the wheels come off pretty quickly.
So you were kind of drawn to the DJ scene, like clubbing scene and raving. Do you think, because, I mean, I guess I can speak about music scenes because I play in a band, and, you know, I've been in and out of bands like since I was a teenager, and it seems to attract kind of, well, I don't know, it's hard to see what came first. It's a bit chicken and egg, like do certain music scenes kind of normalize or promote unhealthy relationships with drugs and alcohol, or are those people that are perhaps a bit more likely to become addicted to things, are they just drawn to those kind of subcultures? It's hard to tell for me. What do you think?
I've lots of people that I partied with early doors, you know, grew out of it. Or did it less frequently, and other things in life became priority. And that just wasn't the case for me, and that was kind of quite clear early on. I mean, back to your question, definitely, you know, I remember my very first sort of experiences. It was me, it was another couple of girls who had also, they were also really young like me, sort of 16, and had really difficult sort of home lives. And so it was, you know, you find this sort of new family through music and through the kind of subculture that you're involved with. For me, it was very much about sort of electronic music and raving. But, you know, before that, I was into bands, and, you know, I always loved that kind of community around music. That was, you know, as much a draw as anything, I think. But also, I just had a real connection to music. Like, I really felt that stuff from a really, really young age. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just was like obsessive, and I was obsessive about music, before I was obsessive about drugs or losing weight or whatever it was. But and then moving to a city at the age of 16 and finding, you know, this new life where people were out, and, you know, I guess there's that kind of elusive sense of connection and community, really, which can be sadly lacking in normal life, you know, in modern life, I guess. And there's that, and that's really, really key. And that's why, I guess, a lot of people are drawn to it. You know, some people who, you know, like me and my friends, who are a bit broken and a bit lost, and other people, you know, who just enjoy that community. That's a human tribal thing that we all kind of need and crave in our lives, I think. Would depend, you know, it doesn't matter if you're coming from a bit of a broken home like we were, or you're pretty stable. Do you know what I mean? Human nature.
Totally. And when did you, I mean, obviously going into, because 16 seems so young to live alone. I know a lot of people do it. I know I've worked with a lot of young people that live alone at 16. That must have been disorientating, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I at the time, it felt like the right, you know, it felt like absolutely the right thing. But looking back now, I feel like, oh my God, I was such a child. And that, you know, obviously there was lots of stuff that impacted. You know, it meant that I didn't kind of continue with education. There was no one really encouraging me to continue with education, and you know, my life did kind of go pretty chaotic. I think it impacted me in all sorts of ways that, you know, perhaps I still you know, still feel now, actually. You know, I think young adults really need kind of guidance, especially at that age. It's pivotal. Just that might just be someone that you trust in. In all sorts of ways, yeah, it kind of impacted me, for sure.
Can you remember when you first went to rehab? How old were you for drugs, I mean, for addiction issues?
So the first time I went to rehab, was actually, it was very much a combination of eating disorder, mental health crisis, and addiction. And that was when I was around 21. I had a detox when I was 19, but yeah, I was around 21. And actually, they didn't really know what to do with me because it wasn't just, it wasn't clear like why I was there. I was referred there by mental health services. But, you know, there was addiction to substances was an issue. I was also starving myself. I was also like heavily bulimic and very underweight. And I was also very suicidal. So like they didn't really know where to put me, like, because, you know, I didn't quite fit into the categories, or I fitted into all of the categories. I didn't know which one to prioritise.
So. Right. And does having an eating disorder or having other issues at play, does that hinder your... I don't know, can that hinder your recovery in the centre? Are they specified for a reason, like you have a drug rehabilitation centre, or are they more multifaceted like that?
I think, I mean, I ended up at that time actually on an eating disorders unit and then going to a drug rehab afterwards. And I found actually I was only really at the very start of my drug career in a way, like, I don't think I was really ready to give that stuff up. I just sort of started scratching the surface of it in a way. Yeah. And I also was just so kind of quite entrenched, I guess, in my eating disorder. I wasn't really kind of ready to let go and give up that stuff. But the consequences were kind of unmanageable to the point where it wasn't like, you know, I couldn't have continued that way. I needed some kind of intervention, but equally, I also wasn't quite ready to throw in the towel and try a new way of life and look at myself and look at my life and take responsibility for myself. Like, none, all of that stuff was a long way off still at that point.
I guess it was
quite a long way off for a few more years.
So when you're coming out of, if you come out of a rehab, and then you said you've relapsed a few times throughout your life, once, how does that happen? Is it triggered by something, and then fuck the progress I've made and. Is it that kind of thing, or you can't remember doing it, or what? How does that happen?
Yeah, I've definitely had lots of experience of this, and I think I sort of see my recovery in a way in two chapters. So there was like, or not my recovery. I mean, from sort of teens to about 29. I don't think I was really ready, so I was always sort of destined to relapse anyway because I hadn't kind of like given up on finding my way of doing it. I wanted to find a way to kind of have another go at using and drinking. I wasn't ready to kind of commit to a life of abstinence. So it was kind of always going to happen. And it happened in so many different ways. Like often it would be like I'd get clean. And then one of my sort of most common things that happened was I'd get clean. I'd become so... sort of like ill with my eating disorder, so it becomes so sort of unhappy that I'd get to a point where I'd just say, well, actually, like having a drink or using would be preferable to this kind of this like living hell that I'm living in. So that was the early thing. But then, you know, what I sort of learnt now, I guess in hindsight, is that like I see myself now as someone who's actually lost the power of choice in whether I use or not, and because I can't see the truth about my own experience at that vital point, you know, whereas someone who like me who's been through the absolute ringer, like has had so much like shit in my life due to using drugs or alcohol, that it would be, you would you would instinctively not do that. It's like, do you know what I mean? Once you've been burnt, you would learn that lesson and move on. But this was a lesson I could not learn on my own. You know, I could not. So when in those vital moments, I would just almost like, it's almost like I'd have like an attack of amnesia where I'd think it's safe for me to go and use again. Whereas like, you know, 10, 15 years of experience shows me it's definitely not safe for you to use. But yet I'd have these attacks of amnesia or, you know, delusion around my own kind of experience. And that is one of them. That is one of the sort of least understood things, I think, about addiction, and one of the least understood by people who with addiction themselves. Like, you know, because the weird thing is, you think, I feel all right, I don't want to use again, you get on with your life, you going about your business, and then one day out of the blue it just comes back, you know. And like you say, it might be because you've got some sort of slight irritation, you know what I mean, there might be something that looks like the reason, but when you really boil it down, no reason is big enough for me to go and do something that's basically going to destroy my life, destroy the life of anyone who cares about me, and kind of take everything of value out of my life and probably kill me. There's no reason big enough for that. But I did it repeatedly. And that's one of the most baffling things about addiction, and one of the least understood by people looking out and people in it themselves, I think.
I know habitual drug takers and drinkers, you know. I like drinking alcohol, and one thing that seems to keep people into a kind of cycle of repetitive bad habits is a social element to it, you know. Perhaps London's big cities are quite bad for it, because you can kind of get anything you want at any time of the day. It's kind of a good thing and a bad thing, depending on if your habits are good or bad, right? Was that something you had to deal with as well? Like, perhaps having to, I don't know, do you have to like distance yourself from friends, or like, or were you kind of pulled back because you think, oh, I really want to hang out with people this weekend, but I don't want to take again. I don't want to take drugs again. So how, like, I've read books written by people who are in recovery, and that was one of the things that one of the writers talked about, was like, he felt really nervous when he was out because he thought, I'm going to relapse, or I just don't feel like I fit in because I haven't got a drink in my hand.
Yeah. So I, hold on a second, I'm just turning the volume down, a little levels down on my mic a little bit. So in one sense, my using wasn't very sociable. I didn't have any friends at the end of my addiction. So it wasn't that, you know, I wasn't out partying. I was using on my own with people who were also like deep in addiction. You know, I was like street using basically at the end of my addiction. I was addicted to crack and heroin. They're not sociable drugs really. But obviously I wasn't always there, and I have memories of, you know, the good times when, you know, drop a pill and have the time of your life at a rave or a festival, and, you know, and go to the afters and all of that stuff. So but addiction had just absolutely stripped everything from me. I didn't have any people around me, other than sort of using buddies at the end. I definitely found social situations difficult at first, and definitely felt, you know, like that social anxiety being out in those environments. I've always loved dancing. I've always loved music. So if there was music and dancing, then I would go for that. Do you know what I mean? I'd be the first person on the dance floor, so I don't have to talk to anyone, basically. Or also, I learned to DJ and started DJing in recovery, which gave me the perfect foil of being able to just hide behind the decks and not have any small talk with anyone. And if anyone tried to chat to me, I could just go, sorry, can't hear you.
No requests.
But I do, you know, but also like that, you know, partying, rave culture, and the music and all of that has always been like a huge part of my identity and love. And I knew I had to find a way to enjoy it sober. And, you know, I didn't want to get sober and, be boring. That was always a priority, was not to have, to live my life basically.
Yeah.
And I didn't see why the part. And I think it's just become much more, thank God, there seems to be like a bit more of a shift and, people, it's much more sort of widely accepted. I see people going sober like all the time these days, which is nice, who haven't reached the depths that I have. They just, want to try out being clear thinking and hangover free for a bit. And because it's like a false confidence, isn't it? So if you're going out and you rely on a drink, basically that bit in the evening where you like you go out, you're around some people, you're feeling a bit awkward, you have a drink and then you start to relax, you always attribute it to the drink, but actually if you don't have the drink you also start to relax eventually. You just adjust to your surroundings, and if you don't have the drink, then you start to build that confidence, actually, of like, actually, I'm all right. I'm still quite socially anxious sort of person, although people wouldn't think it to look at me.
But
I do like to party too, but clean and sober these days.
Okay. Before we get onto your DJing, because I'd love to talk about that as well. Just so we know, we've talked about you in and out of rehab. I understand you were in a all-female rehab at one point. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
What benefits could you see for that? Because that's, because there are many different types of therapy and recovery. And, what benefits did you find being in a single-sex one? Or was there any benefits?
Yeah, definitely loads of benefits. I think it's really, I think there's so many benefits to that. I was in, I've actually been in two, I was quite reluctant to go to it, but I did find, it wasn't just that it was an all-female treatment centre that I went to, it was, they really worked from a trauma-informed perspective, so I was safe to be who I was, and I didn't have to pretend to be anything that I didn't. Like, in previous times I'd been into rehab, I'd been kind of, there's certain rules, like I was told if I acted out on my eating disorder, I'd be discharged, or if I was got into a relationship, I'd be discharged. But with this sort of trauma-informed approach, they kind of worked with you wherever you were at, and so you were safe to be completely honest, basically.
Right.
And I think, coming from a trauma-informed perspective is so valuable. It's vital, I think, in so many different services. And I think it's great that in recent years there's much more awareness around this. But there perhaps wasn't an awareness around this until quite fairly recently. Drug treatment services have all been designed by males for males, essentially. Like the male, it's so interesting how the male is just seen as the default in everything, really. And when you're talking about like working from a trauma-informed perspective with women who are kind of coming out of active addiction, we just know that the rates of sort of child abuse, sexual abuse, violence, domestic violence, all of the that women have lived through. If you have been traumatized and re-traumatized in your life at the hands of men, it's not going to be that healing for you to be in a group with men, unfortunately. Right. I think it is really, you need to create a safe space, and that is more vital than ever, really, in those early days. And that's it.
How did you get clean in the end? Like, well, you've been clean as long as I've known you, for the past 5 years or so I've known you, so it would be hard not to feel a bit hopeless, at this point when you'd been in and out of different rehabs and relapse. Like, what was it that that's ended it all for you?
So it's not, I mean, it's not a straight line. I mean, I basically, what I do now is I work a 12-step program, and that has been the thing that has kept me clean. I think getting into treatment was a really useful start for me because I was so chaotic and I really wasn't very well physically or mentally. I needed kind of a safe place to just get that, those kind of basics in place of like, just like feet, you know, getting off the drugs and getting like my body and mind back to some sort of reasonable state, really. But then it, for me, like engaging in a 12-step program, which is a spiritual program, has been the thing that has kept me clean. And as long as I've done that, I've been okay. And what I found is, I got clean back in 2008, and then I had a relapse in the middle of that time, and yeah, I've been back for like 5 years now. So that's like a whole other story, and that's because, you know, my whole life changed. I got clean. I worked through the 12 steps, and transformed.
If you don't mind. Obviously, you don't have to go through all of them, but what is the 12-step program? I've heard of that before, and I've never really known what it is. What is it like? You said spiritual as well. I didn't know it had that aspect to it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it does, and that is what it is. I think one of the, when you see stuff on TV, like often like people pop up in, you know, you often have the characters at a recovery meeting. For some reason it always seems to be probably because all the writers in America are all in recovery, I reckon. It's also, I mean, maybe it's a good plot device, who knows. It always seems to be people sitting around and just sort of like cathartically sharing all their past traumas and their life stories, and that is not what it is. Like that's not the recovery that I engage with at all. People talk about how to essentially get clean and stay clean, and the 12 steps was kind of devised over 80 years ago by a banker and a doctor, and they, you know, one of them had been working with Carl Jung, and one of them and they'd been, you know, trying different Christian groups and stuff, and they kind of came across this program essentially, and it's kind of admitting defeat, becoming open-minded to something new, some new ideas essentially, you know, like realizing that you don't have the power to change your own life, and so sort of becoming open to trying something new, and then sort of making that decision to do that. And then step four, which is actually just like where you go through your entire life, you write down everything that's kind of bothered you, or your resentments or your fears or your kind of questionable sex conduct, all of that stuff goes down in there. Anything you might have, any guilt, shame, anger, remorse, all of that stuff goes in there, and you look at it from a completely new angle. You look at it from a kind of self-responsibility perspective, and then you go out and make amends to the people that you've hurt in your life. And that's like a long process, but that process in itself, and then you kind of go out and basically show up, you kind of continue to do this, you pray, you meditate, continue to kind of self reflect, or we call it taking inventory, and then you endeavor to sort of practice this in all areas of your life and pass it on to others, so then you take other people through the steps, and that's like the cornerstone of my recovery these days.
So are you a mentor to somebody else?
Yes. Yeah.
And you've got a mentor yourself?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Ah, wow. And the spiritual aspect of it is what? Is that any specific religion?
No, it's not. I mean, and you know, any religion or no religion is welcome there. I think you actually find, if you read the kind of the basic text, which is called the Big Book, you know, there's there's like lots of stuff that's kind of common to other spiritual teachings and spiritual practices and other religions, but it's not dogmatic in that way. It also says, you know, yes, you have to find a higher power or a god of your own understanding, but that can be your own understanding, and and it says don't worry about that too much, because if you go through this process, you're going to have a spiritual experience, and then you won't be able to question. Like, and that was what happened to me, was I didn't I was open to the idea of, you know, spiritual power or God or something, but I just didn't believe in it, if I was really honest with myself. So I was worried that it wouldn't work for me. But going through the process and being kind of completely defeated and open to what may come, and going through, you know, the going down the path that other people had gone, I found that I had a really, really profound internal change.
Wow.
So how I saw the world, how I saw myself, was like, you know, completely different. And and I have to keep up doing this stuff to keep it that way, because if I sort of like stop and slow down or rest on my laurels, then I tend to start, my thinking starts to go a bit skew-iff again, and that's, I guess, when I become sort of disconnected. And I guess, you know, that for me, relapse is always a very real danger, you know.
That sounds really positive. Well, obviously it sounds really positive for people in who are going for addiction, but it sounds positive anyway. It sounds like a positive program for everybody, you know. You know, 'cause a lot of addiction, I guess, is linked to other things, like you said, yours was depression, eating disorders. It sounds like a really positive program for anybody going through some shit. I don't know if it's for sober people, but it did sound really positive.
Yeah, definitely. I guess I think that's what Russell Brand's book was about, really. And you know, he wrote the book Recovery, and I think it was basically making it more kind of like accessible to people, even if they weren't like brought to their knees by addiction. But I think the thing, it is quite drastic, like, you know, actually, you know, like, yes, in theory it sounds great, you know, like, but actually really going to people from your past and say, and making amends and paying back money, and, you know what I mean, like, all of this stuff, you have to have a pretty deep and sincere desire to change, to do this stuff, you know what I mean? And that's why, you know, I guess addiction makes you ready, because it kind of kicks your ass, basically. But, you know, that said, you know, there are now fellowships, you know, for so many different things, and you don't have to be, you know, an intravenous drug addict at all. Like, that's not the majority of people I see in meetings at the moment anyway, you know.
So to get onto your journalism, how did you get into journalism? I understand, tell me, actually, how did you get into journalism and working in broadcast? Because you've done some amazing things. You've worked with BBC Radio Women's Hour, and you've done some personal projects that I guess we'll get onto. But what was your introduction to journalism and to radio journalism?
I had always had an interest in journalism, actually, from a really young age, because I was just like, I used to just devour papers and magazines, and, you know, like, I just was and radio, and of course, I was just like kind of hungry for knowledge, and I always wanted to do it, really. But I think as my life got kind of more and more, kind of, I drifted further and further from the path, basically. Do you know what I mean? It became less and less. Like, my priority really became sort of staying alive. But when I got into rehab when I was like 20, 28, I think, or 29, maybe, I went to this, that's when I went to the all-female rehab in Stroud. And at the time, you know, in the sort of secondary stages where you're sort of like, you've got a bit more freedom, and there's all these sorts of different groups you can go to, and you had like a gardening group and a aromatherapy group and a creative writing group, and they also had a radio skills group. So I started doing this radio skills course, and it was just a really, really tiny little community station. But one of the women working there was an ex-BBC journalist, and she just gave me so much encouragement, and was like, "You've got a real talent for this. You should take it further." And and I thought, and actually there were two ex-BBC journalists there, and they were really encouraging to me. And when I listened back to those shows, I think they were being very, very kind. but I guess I always had something to say, like I wanted to tell stories around stuff. So anyway, I applied to a uni, and I didn't have any qualifications because I'd flunked my education pretty much, but because I had this practical experience at this radio station, they accepted me on this radio production degree course. So I did that, and whilst I was there, I was just coming, it was amazing because I was just, I was newly in recovery, I was just coming alive, I was discovering the world, and I found radio was an amazing medium to do that. And I guess that you do that as well with your writing. It's that's the beautiful thing about it, is you see someone, you're interested in them, or you see something and you're like, what's that all about? And you can go and explore, and you've got a kind of a reason to ask questions and to be there and to meet people and to find out and to become a part of a community and all sorts of stuff. I just got so enthusiastic about it, and nice. Did loads of work experience, and then managed to get in on a new intake scheme at the BBC, and sort of rolled on a few years. Through a chance meeting, I started working for Woman's Hour. I'd pitched some ideas to them, about my own experience, basically. So I think one of the things that happened to me when I got into recovery and I started to get an education was I started to ask questions and started to look at the wider context of my own life experience. And so one of the very first things I did, I remember at uni, one of the first essays I did, I started exploring feminist media studies and the influence of media on eating disorders. And, so I just started to ask questions and put my own experience into the wider context of the world we live in. And one thing that bothered me was, I was going to meetings and I would look around the room and there would be, 25 men and there'd be two or three women. And jeez. It was just seemed to be an accepted fact. And when I asked other people in recovery, they're just like, it's just the way it is. It's just the way it is. We've always struggled to get women. There's not enough women to kind of help mentor new women. And, it just seemed to be an accepted fact, and I couldn't find any sort of satisfactory answers. So obviously, with this new sort of newfound sort of journalistic skills, I just started to do the research around that. And I found that, basically it's true that there are less women that get addicted in the first place. So it's actually 2-1.
Oh.
Men to female, so half the number of females will actually use drugs, although the research is as I later found out is actually pretty questionable, because they miss out very significant groups of people in this research.
What do you mean? Who do they miss out? Sorry,
miss out students, the prison population. And there's another group I've forgotten, but basically, all the research is done on men. So there's so little research on women. That was one of the main things that came out of it. So I still struggle to find the answers to this. But what I found out later was that actually, when you look at treatment services, so that could be community treatment services or rehabs, they're 3/4 men. So so for a woman coming in, that's not only, that's an intimidating, if not unsafe, kind of you know, situation to walk into, especially as we've already established, if you're coming from, if you've got a lot of trauma.
Yeah, related to that, yeah. Related to men, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. So that just sort of like started to play on my mind. And simultaneously, I just found that, you know, media portrayals of addiction, I found them to be quite frustratingly oversimplified. And I just think that women's voices aren't really heard enough, you know, in general. Yeah, I was actually listening to an amazing podcast yesterday about, it's only in the last, it's in such a short amount of time that we've actually even started to listen to women's stories and experiences. Most scientific research is done on men.
Yeah.
And men are just, as I said before, sort of seen as the default. And yeah, anyway, so back to this. I mean, it just started to become a bit of a mission for me, really. I wanted to know why, and I wanted to ask questions, and I wanted to explore different issues. And there were certain parts of my own experience and my friend's experience that I'd never seen, you know, portrayed in the media or discussed in the media, or, you know, so I guess I had something that I wanted to say. When I had this kind of chance meeting with someone who got me like to meet the editor of Women's Hour, and I was able to sort of pitch some of these ideas, and she went for it. And so I started working on a series about women and addiction, and found out like so much more. I mean, it's you know, it was fascinating. Really fascinating.
That series is great. It's a 9-part series called The Fix: Women and Addiction, and you cover loads of different. Every episode's a different kind of area within that bracket. You talk about, you know, eating disorders and addiction, women only treatment centres, you know, addiction and age and prescription medication. What were there any highlights of that for you when making it, like, and also, like, how did it feel? Because it's one thing to come to terms with, you know, everything you've been through and your own recovery, but then want to share your story, or to kind of catalyze change in that way, and kind of, you know, although you're not the center of the radio series, it's kind of very close to home. It couldn't be more close to home. So, like, how was it, and were there any highlights when you were making it?
Do you know what? I actually find it even now very difficult and uncomfortable still to talk about my experience, because,
well,
you know,
thank
obviously
you. Thank you for talking to me today, Anne.
Oh, you're welcome. I mean, but I do feel it's really important to do it. I definitely wasn't going to share my experience when I first started working on that series. That wasn't, you know, that was not given at all. And in fact, it wasn't very done actually. Like in that program, it wasn't, you know, stylistically, you didn't really have kind of personally authored reports so much. So, but I think because I found out, you know, I was saying that actually there's like sort of 3-to-1 male to female ratio in accessing treatment.
Yes.
What that means is that, you know, a quarter of women who use drugs aren't even accessing treatment. And that means that, and why aren't they accessing treatment? A, because we know the treatment services aren't designed for them, so they don't take into consideration that women are often primary child caregivers. Often they're hostile and intimidating places for people, but also because there's so much more stigma for women who use drugs and who are, you know, have addiction problems. It's seen as like it always jumped out to me, this study that they did where they asked university students, so these are young, kind of preferably like quite educated people, and showed them kind of like a woman drinking or using drugs, and it was seen, both male and female judged it to be worse for the women to be drunk or under the influence of drugs. It's seen as more deviant.
Okay.
So there's so much more stigma for women, as you know, as it's just not what we expect from women.
And
it's kind of like,
Yeah, and that prevents people or that hinders people going to get help because they feel deviant. You know, to use that word deviant, or they feel I don't know. It's the stigma around it stops people.
Yeah, exactly. And also, obviously, I mean, you know, the very real threat of having children removed, and you know, but stigma is a huge thing, and we know that from the AIDS epidemic, that if you remove stigma, more people will seek help. You know, that was just proven in that incident. And so, yeah, so I think when I found that out, I realized that like stigma was still such, I mean, I think addiction is still hugely stigmatized, but even more so for women and even more so for mothers, you know. When I found that out, you know, I obviously realized that, you know, my life was in a good place. I'd recovered and I could bring some hope, you know, I could be some kind, you know, in a small way, in my small platform that I have, I could be an example of someone who has recovered and who, you know, so because people, you know, people do write off, you know, it's almost like addicts' lives are disposable, you know, but actually I'm someone who was perhaps could have just been a statistic quite easily. But yet here I am being a human person trying to do some good in the world. And I just sort of felt like it really mattered if I sort of said me too or not in this incident, because it felt like, you know, although it felt quite uncomfortable and quite risky to do so, I felt like it really, really mattered, you know, because I think the more women's voices are heard, the more recovery is visible, of course, like stigma is going to be reduced. We've seen it really working, well with sort of depression and anxiety and mental health problems. And there's, you know, been some really successful campaigns and getting people talking. And I do feel like the stigma has massively decreased for that. And perhaps it has for addiction as well, but I still feel like there's a long way to go. You know, so many people are dying, you know, of addiction. And I think, you know, if it was any other group of people, there would be a public health outcry, you know.
Yeah.
But yet we kind of accept, oh, well, they've sort of like, you know, there's this feeling that, oh, they bought it on themselves. But, you know, that's such a, again, that's such a sort of like, oversimplified kind of perspective, essentially.
Definitely that kind of leads me on to I wanted to talk a little bit about the law and the criminalization of drug users and drug addicts and of drugs, and because Oregon recently in America decriminalized cocaine and heroin and methamphetamine, and I know that they try things out, you know, in the UK, like in Middlesbrough, they're giving people heroin addicts like 2 daily doses of diamorphine, which is clinical grade heroin. What do you think about the law in relation to addiction and drug users and just drugs in general? Because, I mean, well, yeah, you're seen as a criminal if you're a drug addict, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know, like, a huge amount about it, but I do know that, you know, criminalising it does not work. You know, I know that in Portugal as well, I don't know the details of it, but I know that they have kind of treated it as a health problem rather than a criminal issue. Yeah. And that has had amazing results. You know, they've obviously been doing that. They also have, have an amazingly forward thinking approach to sex work. And that's another kind of aspect of addiction, and particularly addiction for women. But yeah, I mean, criminalizing it doesn't work, clearly. I think, you know, one of the pivotal moments in my life was where I was in a courtroom and I was given, you know, I could have easily been sent to prison, and I thought I would be, but because I'd been working with a criminal justice system worker, drugs intervention program worker. She'd got some funding for me to go to rehab, and she managed to convince the courts to let me go to rehab rather than to prison. And you know, that was the time, you know, that I got clean and I went to university. And you know, I mean,
God, thank God for that.
Yeah, but you just sort of think, well, how many other people? And I know that, you know, I've had a lot of there's a lot of privilege in my story because, you know, I'm white, I present fairly articulately, I'm quite well spoken, and I do think I've had more chances than many because of that.
There's a lot of people who didn't, who would have unfortunately gone to jail at that point. So to go on to your DJing, because that's actually grown largely from what, well, in the time I've known you, you've done amazing things with DJing, with your DJ career. And that's obviously totally separate to, I'm not talking about a radio DJ like Alan Partridge, I'm talking about actually DJing. where's that come from? And tell me a little bit about that.
So as we spoke about before, when I was like 16, 17, I was kind of very heavily involved with like underground electronic music and running clubs and I just loved it. And I wanted to learn to DJ then. I wanted to learn to DJ as soon as I knew what it was. But obviously we've heard a little bit about my life. It was pretty chaotic. You know, the last thing on my mind was I could barely keep a roof over my head most of that time, let alone like purchase some decks and start learning how to DJ. So it had to wait till I got clean and in recovery. And I had a few false starts along the way. It was one of the first things I sort of started dipping my toes into as soon as I kind of made some like decent recovery, basically, and kind of was studying and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I suppose I came to it quite late in life. So there was always that sort of like, you know, that kind of inner critic going, oh, what are you doing? You know, oh, you're a bit late now, you know, like.
How old are you though?
So when I first started, I was in my early 30s, and then I stopped again. Because basically life, and I moved up to London and I'd lost my job and I didn't have any money and blah, blah, blah. So
this took off in your later in your 30s.
Much later. And so I was doing a report on this incredible organisation called Girls Rock London for Women's Hour, and they are like sprung from the sort of DIY ethos, and Girls Rock Camp, and they basically got people who, you know, many people who'd never even picked up an instrument, or some people who had, but a mixed group of women, and basically gave them the sort of skills and empowered them mentally, mostly, just pick up an instrument and form a band, write a tune, perform in 3 days. And it was like all the stuff, you know, I realized that I wasn't the only one telling myself all this stuff, you know, like I'd always wanted to make music and do music and DJ. And you know, and be involved with music, and yet I just spent my time hanging around other people doing it, feeling jealous of them, you know, basically I just all these self-defeating thoughts that it wasn't for me. I wouldn't be any good at it. I don't have any right to be there. Blah blah blah. I'm not as good as that person. I'll never be as good as that person. All this sort of self-defeating stuff. Anyway, they just sort of blew it out of the water. And after that, I went and bought. When I bought decks again and started learning, and I think I was like 37 or 38 maybe when I started, 37 I think, and yeah, so after a few false starts before that, that's when I really fully committed. And that's, you know, and as you know, I lived in a warehouse and with a lot of people, and we used to have quite regular parties, and I would take it upon myself to do marathon DJ sets for like 8 hours. Loved it. Yeah. And
you've done some festivals and that, right?
It's been amazing. And I've been doing a radio show for the last couple of years. But yeah, I've played at like Shambhala and Wilderness, and played at the Cause around the corner from us. And yeah, I mean, you know, it's been something that I've just really enjoyed as well, in terms of like, I might not have reached the dizzy heights that I would have perhaps liked to when I was younger, but I love doing it, and I love music, and I love putting together mixes, and I'm just glad to be doing it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. Good for you. So before we go into the three questions that I like to ask people in the one-on-one interviews, have you got, I mean, you know, no pressure if you don't want to, but have you got any advice for people that might be, we'll focus on addiction because we've talked about that mainly. Any advice to anyone that might be, think they might have addiction problems, or maybe are going through what they think is an unhealthy relationship with a substance? Because I guess it could be anything. You got any advice?
I don't like to give advice, but I would say, you know, have a look for a meeting, you know, and maybe go along, especially like now in the pandemic, we're finding that loads of people, we've had loads of people, new people through the doors, because I think it's maybe less daunting, but also if you're locked indoors, it's like there's nowhere to hide anymore from yourself. So I would say get to a meeting. I couldn't possibly tell you which meetings to go to, but a quick Google should help. It's amazing. I mean, I've had a few friends recently who I have known socially for years get into recovery, and it's just been so beautiful to see them kind of get happier, basically, just be happier and just like, just more stable, and sort of see their lives sort of opening out. And all of those people were people who kind of, who's using blended in. Do you know what I mean? Like, don't worry about everyone. Don't worry about everyone else. Like, just think about you. Like, it's like, if it's bothering you, that's the kind of the system. Like, yeah, you can get away with things in life by normalizing it because you're hanging around with people. But at the end of the day, if you're kind of undermining your own morals, then maybe you need to ask for help.
Absolutely. Okay, so can you tell me, I texted you these questions before, can you talk to me briefly about somebody, tell me about someone that you admire and why?
So I am a massive fan of Brené Brown, who is a researcher, storyteller, podcaster, author, sort of self-development person. She did a kind of viral talk about the power of vulnerability. Absolutely incredible. And I just think she's amazing. I love what she's doing and what she's sort of spreading in the world. This kind of emotional, she's very spiritual as well. I believe she's also a sober person, though she doesn't really talk about it much.
Okay.
She's a good couple of decades so sober as well, I think. But yeah, she's incredible. That was a podcast I was listening to yesterday, which was awesome, about all about women's, if women, you know, were the storytellers throughout history, because going back, you know, as old as time, the story of Adam and Eve, obviously, is told from the male perspective. And it would probably be a very different story if Eve was the one doing the telling.
Yeah, I imagine it would be, yeah. So you recommend the podcast, her podcast, Brené Brown?
Yeah, and all of her books as well.
Okay, great. And can you tell me about a challenge? Well, we've talked a lot about challenges that you've overcome. Can you tell me about a specific challenge that you've overcome and how it made you feel?
Okay, I'll go with learning to mix on vinyl. It actually took me quite a long time to learn to mix on vinyl. I thought I'd just get it straight away because I had like quite a lot of experience by that point of like DJing digitally and stuff, but actually learning to mix one record into another, it took me quite a long time to do it to a reasonable standard, to be honest.
Yeah.
A lot of practice. And that was, but that's good, you know what I mean? And that felt really amazing. So the very first time I played out an all vinyl set was actually on my 40th birthday.
Wow.
At a little party that I had, well, it was like a little mini festival. It was amazing. I was meant
to come. I didn't come. I'm sorry about that. I really regret not coming now because it looked amazing.
You missed out. But yeah, that was a really amazing feeling. Playing out to, I love playing to, DJing to my friends and playing all vinyl. I mean, no one else gave a shit really, but I did.
Yeah.
And I definitely did train wreck at least one mix, but you know, like seeing everyone enjoying it was amazing. And I was also nearly 3 months pregnant, which was a secret at the time.
Oh, nice.
So double good.
Okay, great. And one hope or dream you have for the future?
I hope that I am a good mum to Wolfie, that I stay clean and sober and continue to kind of improve and grow as a person so that I can give him the love and solid start in life that he deserves. That's my little boy, by the way, obviously.
Yeah, you can't argue with that. Amazing. I can't wait to meet him anyway.
He's lush. You'll love him.
Which I will next time I'm in Bristol or next time you're in London if you bring him down.
Yeah, no, I'd love that. I need to bring him up to visit some people soon.
Yeah, for sure.
When lockdown's over.
Yes, of course, yeah. All right, well, thank you so much for talking to me today, Millie.
Oh, good.
I've loved it, and I've loved to get to know you a little bit more, and through understanding your journey, I know I will understand other people's journeys who have been through addiction. That no story's the same, but, you know, there are similarities. There might be similarities, 100%. Sorry. Where can we listen to your radio? Sorry, to your DJ sets. Yeah, I know you've got a radio show, right?
I have, but I'm actually in between radio shows at the moment.
Okay.
I have it all on Mixcloud, actually. I keep them all on Mixcloud. But yeah, if you want to follow me or find out any more about what I'm doing, you can follow me on Instagram. I tend to post all my links up there.
Yeah.
I'm at Millie_on_air.
Millie on air. All right, nice one, Millie. Well, have a nice night. And I'm sending lots of love to you and Wolfie and your beautiful family.
Oh, thank you, Jack. Lots of love to you too.
Speak to you in a bit.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Human Magic Podcast. It's all put together by me, Jack Hutchcraft. If you do struggle with addiction, or would like to learn more about what help is out there, I'm going to include some links in the description of this podcast, so whether that's on Apple or Spotify, I'll make sure the links are there, a little bit of information. If you're interested to find out more about what I do, some of my journalistic work and what have you, you can see it all at jackhutchcraft.com. Thank you, beautiful listeners. Go easy, love yourself, believe in yourself. You can do anything. Every day is a new opportunity to start down the path that you would like to be on. Peace and love, peace and love.